This is the black team's final change of shift briefing. And from my left, let me introduce our participants today. On my immediate left, Glenn Lunny, flight director of the black team. Jerry Bostic, retro fire officer for the black team. Major General Vincent Houston, DOD manager of manned space flight support operations. And Mr. Jerry Hammack, chief of the Landing and Recovery Division at Manned Spacecraft Center. We'll open with Glenn Lunny.
Very briefly, what we'll do here for you this evening is briefly review the work that we had to do today, which was really not very heavy. Jerry Hammack will talk about some of the aspects of the entry and the recovery posture. General Houston will be glad to answer any questions you have in the recovery or support area. And Jerry Bostic has been working out a lot of the numbers for retrofire and entry, and I know a lot of people are always interested in getting exact times, et cetera, so we'll try to help you out there. Very briefly, we came on duty at about 119 hours. We were at an altitude above the Earth of about 126,000 miles. We had, over the whole day, a generally quiet day, primarily of passive thermal control and P-23, that is the navigation program work. At 120 hours, we moved into the program 23, the navigation work off the stars. At about that time, also, you heard some discussion about loss of a transducer in the primary radiator loop. We lost the rad out temp. That's no problem. There are plenty of other measurement points in the loop, and we're satisfied that the loop is working properly, as has been demonstrated by its performance all day. During the navigation work, we have been watching one quad in particular rather carefully. It's not that the quad is especially hot or especially near any limit. It is just hotter. Quad A is slightly hotter than the other quads, so we are doing what we can to favor it so that the overall balance of the spacecraft, the thermal balance of the spacecraft, remains about even. Frank reported all good sleep for all three crew members. They seem to be feeling real fine. They're very chipper, and I think they've all got about 7 hours their last time out. And one or two of them are just getting settled down now for another couple hours before the entry work tomorrow. 121 hours and a half, they chlorinated the water. Mid-course 6 was scheduled for today for this shift at 122 hours elapsed. However, because of the current accuracy of the trajectory, there was no need to do that. The maneuver was on the order of 0.4 of a foot per second today, and we would not do any maneuver that small, since that's essentially noise level in how well we know what maneuver to perform. By the way, the maneuver tomorrow, mid-course 7, which occurs 2 hours prior to entry, it will be on the order of 2 feet per second. As you know, the exact number will continue to be refined during the course of the night as we get more tracking in, but it's a pretty small maneuver and will be that big. Even if we didn't make that maneuver, we would still be comfortably in the corridor. More navigation work and more passive thermal control. And that went on for several hours. We started charging a battery. Charge battery B up so that essentially we have three almost completely full up battery charged batteries. We have about 117 point something amp hours in the batteries out of the potential 120 amp hours. At 128 hours elapsed, we had a short TV show. It was preceded by a checkout, which was also several minutes long. The TV pictures were entirely of the Earth. At that time, the altitude above the Earth was 96,000 miles, and the velocity was about 6,100 feet per second. I understand that we are trying to make a sketch-up of the picture that we got with sketches underneath, as you know, on weather maps with the continents, etc., and some people are doing that, and we hope to make that available sometime, perhaps towards the end of this press conference for you.
Let me insert it this point, Glenn. We do have a slide made up by a gentleman here at the Manned Spacecraft Center, Dick Underwood, and we propose to project it at the end of the news conference on this screen and have Dick go over some of the features that are shown.
Okay, fine. That briefly summarizes the shift that you just heard. The next shift is, again, a fairly quiet one. There will be some more navigation work, and when we're not doing that, we'll be in the passive thermal control mode. We will be then, when we get all three crew members up, there'll be the final preparations. Mostly these preparations are by way of stone the cockpit, final preparations for the entry. There'll be a mid-course, a small one, as we've already discussed, tomorrow morning, and then the final entry. Jerry Hammack, perhaps now, will tell us about the entry.
Well, the recovery situation. I prepared a few quick charts over here to sort of set the stage, and we'll be glad to answer any questions that you have, but I was gonna go over the, the sequence and what we would expect, and I'm going to cover later the times and the logistics of arrival of the crew in the spacecraft. Any questions having to do with reentry, of course, would direct to Jerry Bostic. I'm just setting the stage here that after the command module spacecraft separation, we come on into entry, plus 15 minutes after that into entry at 400,000 feet and come on in for the landing. The details of that are shown here now as we get into the landing phase. This is the descent phase. At the command module plus space plus service module separation, plus 23 minutes from that time, the apex cover is jettisoned, immediately followed by the drogues. The drogues are deployed at 24,000 feet. We're counting here now from command module, service module separation, plus times from that.
Plus
23 minutes, 24 seconds.
What happens?
Then that's when the apex cover is jettisoned, and the drogue chutes are released to stabilize and slow the spacecraft down. Slows it to about 300 miles per hour, 300 in that neighborhood. At 10,000 feet or plus 24 minutes and 38 seconds, the drogues are released and the pilot chutes pull out the mains, the 83-foot diameter ring sail mains. This is at 10,000 feet. Now this gives you a descent velocity at the surface around 31 feet per second, where we have landing 28 minutes and 46 seconds from command module, service module separation. I'm going to go into more detailed times as far as local times in a minute. This corresponds here to 4:45 local in the recovery area, or as far as our time here, 9:45 Central Standard Time, Houston. So you can count back from here if you like. I'll get into those times in just a minute. Now, one thing I'd like to bring out is the landing attitude of the spacecraft and the possibility of the stable 2 condition that we had last time, and I think we ought to be prepared for that eventuality, as we've had it on the last two spacecraft, and we've got a pretty high probability, as far as the probability numbers are concerned, to going into a stable 2 attitude. However, the normal attitude is to come down in this condition right here. The harness aligns the spacecraft at 27 degree angle to give you a better penetration entry into the water to lessen the landing impact. Now, at landing, the crew punches off the parachute, releases the parachute, and the recovery retrieval proceeds. However, if we get pulled over by the parachutes or wave action into a stable 2 mode, immediately upon landing in the stable 2 mode, the command pilot would start the inflation sequence, pumping up 3 bags that are capable of uprighting the spacecraft and putting it into the stable 1 condition. Now, this sequence, as far as how long it takes to do this, varies. It can be as low as around 4.5 minutes, but it can be as much as 12 minutes. This particular crew here, Frank and Jim and Bill, in our training out in the Gulf when they were out there, the trainer spacecraft took 12 minutes to upright. Now, when it's in this stable 2 condition, you understand the antennas are underwater so that you do not get any electronic signals, so we should be prepared for that. It hangs about like this. Actually, it's in that relationship. We have on this number 4 bulkhead, we have the VHF beacon antenna. We have the voice antenna on this bulkhead and a flashing light over here. So when it's in that, in a stable 2 condition, which is even further over than this showed with the bags, all the antennas are underwater, so we get no signals. So depending upon what that time is, from 4.5 to, we'll say on the outside, 12 minutes, we will get no signals. Now, we start getting signals immediately when it's in the water, we know it's in the stable 1 attitude. What? Yes, the antenna. Yes.
What position are the crew in when they're in stable 2?
They are upside down. Normally they are in here, as you know, in the couch, and so they are just over like that. Now, so this is a normal, and this is, the probability of this is enough so that we don't consider it a very abnormal kind of a situation. We've designed for it. We have the flotation bags to bring it up into stable 1 condition. It only takes 2 of the bags, in fact, to bring it up into stable 1 condition. You might be interested in knowing the location aids that we have aboard the spacecraft. We have what you just referred to as the recovery beacon. This is a VHF beacon that operates at 243 megacycles. We have the VHF voice. Then we have a survival radio in case we need that. This would be in case you did a stable 2 egress, if that was required, and you'd have that radio in your 3-man life raft. The ranges of this equipment are up to 195 nautical miles, depending upon the altitude of the search aircraft. And we have the flashing light, which will be turned on at main chute. And by the way, these are actuated. The VHF recovery beacon is actuated at the main chute. The flashing light has 2 rates, one 120 flashes per minute and one 15 flashes per minute. Then as far as to augment the visual cues, we have the C-dye marker, which is a yellow-green color. 120 if you're in the vicinity of the recovery forces, which we expect. The 15 rate would be in a contingency kind of a thing to conserve battery power. Jim Shannon, do you have about 8 miles? So it's a white light.
Strobe light?
Yes.
What is the duration of when you run out of battery power at 120 and at 15?
Say that again.
How long will it flash at 120 and how long will it flash at 15?
When it runs out of battery power? Well, won't flash anymore when you give
it. Does it take to run out of battery power?
Is it 12, Jim?
Well, it's running off the spacecraft batteries, so it could last 10 or 12 hours. It'd be just a matter of how long your batteries in your spacecraft would last.
Yes, but I think he's asking something different. On the water, we would have capability to stretch the batteries up to 24 hours or so with a normal entry. Yeah, that's the least of the power requirements.
And then it has to do, too, with the amount of battery power that's left. At that point, we should have a hack on that from the flight control people. Okay, so much for the recovery aids. This is a really sort of a duplication of what you've seen in the press kit with a little bit of updating. I don't know whether you can see it out there, but it's our terminal area landing ellipse, which is roughly 800 by 300. And we have the carrier position at the end of mission aim point. Downrange, in case we had a weather avoidance problem, we have positioned another ship, a secondary ship that has a recovery capability. And then we have an array of three C-130 aircraft that cover the whole area with the direction finding equipment to DF in on the beacons that I was describing earlier. Right now, the intermission target point that I'm carrying, Jerry Bostic might can update this, is 8 degrees, 8 minutes north, by 165 degrees west. Is that correct now, Jerry? Our landing time that we are carrying as of right now, as I said earlier, is 4:45 a.m. local time, that is local in the recovery area, which corresponds to 9:45 a.m. here. Now, as you know, we've stated that this is a nighttime landing. I put on here for your reference the time of sunup in the area, 6:10 a.m. local. However, you start getting some light, what the almanac called this civil twilight, at 5:47. So you see we have roughly about an hour of darkness, although General Houston informs me that they ran a simulation out there this morning and they started getting effective light about 15 minutes earlier than that. So we'll have about a 45-minute period of darkness. Now, the situation, the guidelines that we've adopted, and General Houston has passed this out to the operational forces, is we will not drop swimmers until light. And I think we ought to stress this point here, to let you know our plans. If the spacecraft is in good condition, the crew is in good condition, and the weather isn't worsening, we can see no reason to drop swimmers at night. So, we're in good calm. In other words, everything in a stabilized condition, we're not worried about anything. If we're worried about anything, or if the crew tells us, says that he'd like to have the swimmers down there, or if the weather is worsening, then the on-scene commander has authority to go ahead and drop the swimmers. But right now, we expect not to do that.
Why would you not drop swimmers at night? Is there some particular danger in that?
Well, it's just easier to work in the daytime than it is at night. However, the swimmers have capability to do this. They have done this. These are very highly trained UDT swimmers. General Houston, you might mention the capabilities of these UDT people.
Well, we've actually done it in the dark during the simulations in preparation for the mission. So it can be done, but NASA assures us that the spacecraft floats well. There's no reason to go charging off preliminarily, and we've mutually agreed that discretion indicates that if we have good communications with the astronauts, if their condition is good, if the spacecraft is floating well, and they prefer to remain in the spacecraft, which has been discussed with the commander previous to the mission, we'll hold the swimmers into the air until they have adequate daylight to do the collaring job. And however, if any of these factors change, or if the crew decides they prefer to have swimmers in the water now, they will go in the water.
As a matter of fact, one of the crewmen, Jim Lovell, participated in a 48-hour qualification test off a spacecraft in which he was out there in the Gulf for 48 hours, day and night. We were station keeping on him with a retriever, and we've pretty much proven that this is a good vessel. So it just doesn't seem to be an advantage to get them out early if they don't need to be taken out. Yes, sir. That would be up to the evaluation of the crewman, how sick he personally is. And he'd have to call on that point.
Yeah, if we have questions, can we raise our hands and wait for the mic, please?
Are the recovery helicopters equipped with lights similar to the ones they have in Vietnam?
They have lights, and they will put them on. Just as an added factor that if we have electronic fix problems, the crew may see the helicopters, you see. They may be in voice contact, so it's just an added factor in darkness that might work to our advantage if the weather is good enough.
What will happen? Will the helicopters remain hovering with the spacecraft lit and the swimmers still in the choppers?
Yes.
And this will go on for an hour or so?
45 minutes 45 is our minutes. Estimate based on this morning's exercise.
45 minutes is the estimate for what?
It is the estimate from splash time to the point where the helicopter aircraft commander will feel that he has enough visual light before dawn, before official sunrise, in order to do the job visually, you see. He is prepared, however, to go in before that point if necessary to follow the spacecraft.
So you don't expect a pickup or an opening of the crew hatch until at least 5:30 local time?
Yes, that is our plan. That is our plan now. Now, as I say, we're prepared to go in immediately if we find the spacecraft. But our plan is 5:30, yes. Approximately.
What is that civil twilight read up there? I can't read. Is it 5:07 or 5:40?
The civil twilight, according to the nautical almanac, is 5:47.
5:47.
But as General Houston just said, it seems that we got some effective light before that civil twilight, about 15 minutes earlier.
Now, this is associated with the weather. We had clear skies this morning, so you could see a few minutes earlier than if you had over.
But that 45 minutes would be optimum then. That would be the best you could do.
I think that's optimum, yes.
Could we get a weather update in the recovery zone?
Well, you want me to?
Why don't you go ahead? I think you might have gotten a later forecast.
My weather briefing has been fairly consistent for the past 36 hours, and it is 2,000 foot scattered, 12,000 foot broken, high overcast, 10 miles, 4 foot waves, and 10 miles visibility. Good weather. Scattered showers.
How about wind?
10 knots.
This landing point is in the ITC area, in a tropical zone of convergence. It sort of hangs around in there, and these are typical, as General Houston says, this has been the forecast for the last 36 hours, fairly stable situation, but certainly adequate recovery conditions.
Now, we will run a weather recon 12 hours before splash time tonight, and we'll have on-scene weather recon from the air, and of course we have the ship's observations.
General, on the previous recoveries, there's been a data pickup from the carrier by means of the aircraft and C-130 balloon type pickup. Can you tell us whether or not there will be, or has there been in the past, still photo pictures from the photo pool picked up in that package of data?
Well, we have that capability, and I seem to have overheard them talking about it. Now, I can't really answer your question specifically, but I have the impression at the moment they are planning.
I think that's correct. They use this star system where they have a balloon released from the deck and they fly over it with a C-130 aircraft and snatch it. And I believe that has been laid on for this flight. I believe
it can be done. I think it's been laid.
I have two questions. Is it the first recovery during the darkness? And second question is, what time do you estimate that the Apollo 8 spaceship will enter the corridor, 35 miles corridor?
Well, the first question, this is the first time we've had a nighttime landing. Of course, this is just, as we said, 45 minutes an hour into that. As far as the corridor, I think we should ask Mr. Bostic over here to answer that question.
146 hours, 46 minutes.
That's right.
That's an altitude of 400,000 feet.
There's about still 11 minutes before splashdown.
I'm sorry, say again.
That's still 11 minutes before splashdown.
11 minutes before splash. Let me check my arithmetic. Splash should be at 147.
I got 28 minutes, 46 seconds there, Jerry. Entry to landing, is that?
That's right.
28 minutes, 46 seconds is what I'm carrying on that.
I wonder if you could tell us what the trajectory is going to be after. 400,000 feet.
40,000 feet?
400,000 feet.
400,000 feet is entry, and from entry to landing, I'm carrying 28 minutes, 46 seconds.
From entry to landing?
Right.
That doesn't way it look. Doesn't, not the way it looks. Way
separation, command module, service module, separation to entry is 15 minutes.
I wonder if you could tell us the trajectory from 400K down and the G-forces involved. We've seen skip demonstrations, we've seen, and we understand they're wrong, and we've been told that the maximum G would be 6.8. We've been told the maximum G would be constant at 4. And can you breeze through it very quickly to pin down these details for us?
Okay, the with the current entry profile that we're planning to fly, the maximum G will be 6.8. Now that will, that peak, the first peak will occur about 80 seconds after entry interface, 400,000 feet. Then at about 360 seconds after entry interface, they'll have another spike up to about 6 Gs. And the if you're interested in the duration of those spikes, the first spike above 4 Gs, the time spent above 4 Gs, is about 40 seconds. And on the second spike, it's about 45 seconds above 4 Gs.
Could we have a schedule of the debriefing situation? And John, what's the family situation as far as reunions are concerned?
I don't have the debriefing schedule for the flight crew. I'm sure Deke Slayton will
have
that
tomorrow. I've got the logistics of them coming back. Why don't I finish up this and then go on to the question? I was about through with this chart. I wanted to point out, however, that we have tracking. We have a tracking station and two ships to update the accuracy of this landing point. We have the Guam station over here that covers the entry and pre-entry area. We have the Redstone in the pre-entry area. We have the Redstone tracking ship. We have the Huntsville tracking ship that gets about 1 minute in blackout on the C-band beacon and about 4 minutes after. All of this information feeds in that aids us in the prediction of that landing point, which General Houston passes on out to the recovery forces. So I guess that pretty much takes care of this chart. Let me go show you a little bit of the logistics here, and that's my final chart. It touches on your question. The crew will spend the night aboard the ship and leave the next morning, Saturday the 28th at noon, Hawaii time, which is 4 o'clock local time, our time here. They'll fly off aboard by cart aircraft, fixed-wing cart aircraft, into Hickam. They'll arrive there at 2:30 p.m. and quickly get into an awaiting C-141. We've estimated C-141 depart Hawaii at 3 p.m. Hawaii time, 7 o'clock our time, to arrive at Houston or Ellington early the next morning, the 29th, Sunday, at 4 a.m. So the activity of the crew after that, I'm not aware. Command module, the command module will be offloaded in Hawaii at Fort Allen on Sunday, December the 29th at 8 a.m. Hawaii time. It'll depart Hawaii 3 days later. It takes 72 hours to deactivate the spacecraft, departing there at 8 a.m. January the 1st, Wednesday, for arrival back in Los Angeles, in Long Beach, actually, for transport to the Downey plant, arriving there at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Okay, that completes.
Okay, why don't we open for questions officially now, John Wilford?
I had a question in the transcript. You mentioned a point where the beyond which you could not land in the Atlantic or the Indian Oceans. Before you reached that point, how would you have changed your trajectory to land in the Atlantic or the Indian Ocean? Would it have been a SPS burn or?
Yes.
SPS burn.
That's right.
I have two questions. I thought Splash was scheduled for 147.0024 or thereabouts. Is that correct?
That's right.
Well, that doesn't work out 28 minutes from 400K. That's like 14 minutes.
That's right. Where'd you get the 28 number?
I'm sorry, what?
I say 14 is right, from entry interface to landing.
Right, okay.
The 28 that he was talking about is from separation, roughly. Actually, it's close
to 29. I wonder if it'd be possible for us to get those figures again on the crew activities after recovery. If you could just run through the times, I would appreciate it.
What's your time after recovery? Okay. Can you see that? Or you want me to read it
again?
do these two peaks of G forces mean that you are using the skip technique at reentry?
That's true. The entry will be under control of the guidance and navigation system on board the spacecraft. It is a skip, but not a skip out, of course. Yeah. I don't like the word skip, really.
Why is it called constant 4G?
That is the backup technique you're referring to, the constant 4G backup, the manual crew backup.
You've succeeded in confusing me entirely.
Could we? Could you tell us what the diameter of the corridor is, if that hasn't changed along with everything else?
That's a question I've never known how to answer, and I always get it like, how high and how wide is the corridor in miles? And the corridor, the way we are concerned about it, is measured in degrees of flight path angle below the local horizontal. It's an angle. Now, the angle that we are shooting for is 6.5 degrees below horizontal.
Well, we've heard 30 miles, and we've heard 26 miles, and is there a mileage figure you can put on it that we can make things plain to the people that read the newspapers?
I'm not sure what measurement you're talking about.
He's talking about vacuum perigee, Jerry.
Oh, the vacuum perigee altitude?
Yeah, the mouth of the corridor that you have to shoot this thing through to get it down without burning them up.
Located at an angle of 6.5 degrees to the horizontal. Isn't that basically what it is? Hey, you have to get it into that cone.
When you get to 400,000 miles, you have to be at Jerry Bostick's angle of 6.5 degrees below the horizontal, plus or minus about a degree. In order to be either remain captured or on the underside not pull more than 10 G's.
Okay, but the plus or minus 1 degree would
translate.
It's a
measurement of how steep or how shallow the velocity vector is at 400,000 feet, which is defined as entry altitude.
But the point is that at that point, the point you're aiming for,
yes,
plus or minus 1 degree,
yes,
would give a circle in space with a diameter of 30 nautical miles. Is that correct?
It is about 30 nautical miles. I am not sure that's the exact number, though. Okay?
For General Houston, is that weather you gave us the current weather or the forecast weather?
Forecasted weather.
Do you have a current weather there now, sir?
No, I don't, but it was at least this good as the forecast. Yes, and I hope I remember it accurately, and I'm certain I am, but it was 2,000 feet scattered, 12,000 feet broken, high overcast, 10 miles visibility, 10 knots, 4-foot waves.
Now, let's hold
scattered
up
shower.
Let's hold up to the mic, please. Harry Pease.
I'd like to clarify this splash time, which has been given as 4:45 a.m. local. It has been given as 37:00024 for, or at any rate, the it would come out to be 51:24 local time instead of 45, and then we've got 14:28 involved. Could somebody square me away on this?
I can. Is this okay? I can tell you the splice time is. Is correct. It's really not very much different from the pre-flight planning time. I've been carrying this tatted sheet from the time we were planning this mission, and it shows here 4:54 local out there instead of 4:45. So it really hadn't changed very much. It's 4:45 local time in the area, which corresponds to 9:45 Central Standard Time. Now, that's what I said.
He said 4:54.
4:54 was the earlier time. That's right. That was the time, as of, say, 3 weeks ago. Well, right now, in real time, 9:40, that's right, 9 in.
That means the mission is no longer 1:47:00:24 long, right?
I haven't counted it up. Have you counted up? I guess that's it. That's right. There's a difference of nine minutes.
Could we?
I want to nail down this time between 400,000 feet and splashdown once and for all. Is it 14 minutes?
400,000 feet to landing, entry to landing is 28 minutes, 46 seconds.
Here we go again. We just had your retro man say 14.
I believe Jerry Bostic has got a sequence from entry interface on. Why don't we just run through that, and it might turn out to be in ground elapse time, which I'm sure all of our good people here can convert very easily.
Okay, you're right about being in ground elapse time. Unfortunately, the only thing I have in local time happens to be landing, and another unfortunate part about that is it doesn't agree with Jerry's number. But I think that must be a little old. The ground elapse time of 400,000 feet is 146 hours, 46 minutes, and 13 seconds. GET for splash is 147 hours and 11 seconds.
What is your real time for splashdown? You say it doesn't agree with his.
Yeah, why don't we hold on?
Sorry, the local
second.
Time?
Yeah.
I'll give it to you in Greenwich Mean Time.
It's
it's 15:51:11. Then I think that works out to be 4:51:11 in the local area.
4:51. That is yours. Now, which of you is right? You are.
These numbers are right. Yes.
Okay. So in effect, it's splashdown is 4:51. Local time, Hawaii time, right?
That's right.
Do you want to go through the intermediary numbers you have there, Jerry, and maybe this will just kind of hold off any further questions on the subject?
Okay, the ground elapsed time of initiation of blackout is 146, 46, 38. Exit blackout time is 146, 4941. 146, 4941. Drogue deploy 146, 5427. Main deploy 146, 5514. Now, I hope you understand that tomorrow when you hear some more numbers that you won't argue about the seconds. And I might point out that the information that I have just given you is based on doing a final mid-course correction at 2 hours prior to entry interface.
Is the profile of the entry that's in the press kit showing the two little bumps still accurate?
I have to admit I haven't seen it, but it has two little bumps.
Why? In order to retain uniform G, but it still does not retain uniform G, is that correct?
It does not maintain uniform G.
But nevertheless, the bumps are designed to minimize the increase in G at those points.
That and to maximize the ranging capability, and there are several factors.
When the spacecraft completed TEI, was it headed without further corrections into that 30-mile corridor, or if it was not, how far off was it? Could you give us an idea on that? In other words, did the mid-course corrections put it closer to the middle of the corridor or into the corridor?
To tell you the truth, I don't. I wasn't on duty when the one mid-course correction was done, and I don't recall the exact numbers on that. I know that we weren't very far away from the corridor. We couldn't have been for that small of a correction. I don't have the exact numbers.
We can find that out, though, and send it back over. Okay.
John Lennon.
I hate to return to the matter of the entry corridors and the G-force approach, but is this or is this not the 4G reentry, which just happens to have a couple of humps in it in order to keep things so that it averages out to a 4G reentry?
Look, the intent of this thing is not to fly a constant 4G entry. The intent of the thing is to fly the guidance system the way it was designed to fly. And in the ultimate case, it skips back. It comes in and skips back out. Now, what we're flying instead of the long range, 2,500 nautical miles, we're flying 1,300 nautical miles. So it does a very compressed version of that, which doesn't really let it go up very much, and it shortens in and comes in at the two peak Gs that Jerry described earlier. The constant 4G discussion derives from the fact that, as a simple-minded way of backing up this kind of entry, the pilots could pull 4Gs when they got it on their G-meter and just roll to hold that 4Gs, and they would essentially at least approximate the guided trajectory and land at about the same place. So the constant 4G is a backup technique that derives from the way the guidance system steers the spacecraft during the entry, which is designed to cover the whole range of entry conditions and ranges that we might want to fly.
Now, does the skip out possibility still exist under the guidance system, which will be in effect at the time of reentry? If you hit your corridor at 6 degrees plus or minus 1 degree, under the program that's in that computer, does the potentiality for skip out still remain?
If the program were to malfunction, it could skip out. Okay.
Glenn.
But there are techniques developed for the pilot to monitor what the computer is doing to be sure that does not happen. Okay?
Glenn, aside from the two spikes of G's on the entry, what will be the approximate G load that they'll be seeing through that?
Jerry, what does it average out at, G's? At the risk of opening up constant 4G again.
Yeah, I almost hate to say it. It almost averages out 4Gs, but don't get hung up on that again. It goes up to 6, and it comes down to around 1, and it goes back up to 6 again.
Harry Pease.
Will the pilots be heads down at 400K, and can you describe to us how they'll roll the spacecraft to follow this track as they land?
Jerry, no tell.
If I'm sure I understand your question, at 400,000 feet, the crew will be heads down in a horizon monitor attitude.
And then what happens? How will they roll? How does this program take them? 50 degrees right, 50 degrees left, and that sort of thing?
There's no way I can answer that, because the guidance system is going to be under control, in control of the spacecraft. The crew knows what to expect about how far it will roll right or left. It's very sensitive to whether it will roll initially right or left, though.
No, Jerry, it's sensitive to whether it rolls right or left, depending on whether the target is right or left. But describe the roll program for the in-plane lift. That might
help. Okay, well, I'm not sure I can describe it exactly in words. I have a graph of it here that I'd be glad to show you. It starts out heads down, of course, and then the bank angle goes over to 180 degrees, heads up, and it stays there for about 20 to 30 seconds, then back to heads down.
Very good.
That's right.
So heads down, turn heads up half a minute, then turn back over.
That's correct.
Nick Lyons.
All right, Glenn, if the reentry corridor, again, if the axis of the reentry corridor is 6.5 degrees, plus or minus 1 degree, from the horizontal, what are the range of
variations that would, in one case, skip the spacecraft out of the atmosphere, and in another case, in the case of not a shallow but the converse, a very direct entry, at what angle would the spacecraft could the spacecraft come in that would disintegrate it? In other words, what are the upper and lower angles involved here for the worst possible situation?
Well, the 1 degree shallow represents a skip trajectory because it's coming in too shallow and isn't digging in enough.
5.5 degrees.
Yes. And that is kind of arbitrarily defined as exceeding a certain range. Jerry, do you recall the range?
It's 2,500 nautical miles.
Once we hit at angles less than 5.1 degrees, we would start flying trajectories in excess of 2,500 miles. Now, that is what we arbitrarily call a skip because it is starting to get past the normal control range of the spacecraft guidance. What we call too steep is again a degree on the other side, or 7.1, and at this level we start to exceed what, 10 G's full lift?
That's right.
This again is another, it's just a standard to measure it because the G's obviously just increase, and we've picked 10 G's full lift as the crew limit, which we wouldn't want to exceed at the lower side of the corridor.
Excuse me just a second. I think we have part of Harry Pease's question left unanswered, and you might pick up on that one, Jerry.
I'm sorry, which question?
That was a question before.
I don't know if we heard the end of Harry's question.
Yeah, we were flying them in. We started heads down. We rolled heads up for 20 seconds. Then we went back to heads down, and there we left them. Can we pick them up at that point and bring them on down to drogue?
Okay, then heads down for approximately 100 seconds. Then a gradual roll over to the side, not all the way back, heads up, but heads almost horizontal.
Give it to us in degrees. We can translate.
100 degrees from straight down. That's 10 degrees above the horizontal end. And they remain essentially at that attitude for another 100 seconds, and then go all the way to heads up and remain essentially in that position for about another 120 seconds until the drogue chutes are deployed. Then, of course, I understand those are pretty rough numbers, and I'll be glad to pick any little points off of the curve here if you'd like.
That's fine, thanks.
If they chose to come in at a constant 4G, what would the time, the length of time be?
The time of the entry?
The length of time they would be at 4G, at constant 4G.
I don't have the exact number. It would be very close to the numbers I gave you for a guided entry. And that's one of the main reasons that on this flight we are flying an entry range of approximately 1,300 nautical miles, because the backup technique that the crew would use very closely approximates the profile for the guided entry.
Jerry, I think he's interested in knowing whether it's a minute or 2 minutes or what. Approximately
above the 4G level. I don't have the exact number. All I can say is it would closely approximate the guided entry.
Of
course, it depends on
be?
Exactly how the crew flies it. You understand it's a manual technique, and one pilot would probably fly it a little bit different than another one.
Okay, why don't we take about two more questions and call it a day? Eh?
Is any part of the reentry, is the lift factor during any part of the reentry, due to any change in pitch, or is it all roll?
Oh, the lift?
Yeah.
I'm not sure this answers your questions, but the lift is a function of the location of the center of gravity of the spacecraft, away from the longitudinal axis.
How do you move the center of gravity? By rolling the spacecraft or by pitching it?
You don't move the center.
Well, I'm
Lift is controlled by rolling the vehicle around the aerodynamic axis that it assumes when it comes in.
I see. So there is no pitch to increase lift.
No. As a matter of fact, you couldn't pitch it if you want to once you get in the atmosphere, because the jets couldn't overcome the aerodynamic load.
In the heads down configuration, the lift vector is up and vice versa.
The gentleman on the third row, and then we'll take Mr. DeLong, and that's it.
Glenn, how is the EMS behaving?
How has it behaved? Well, we had one difficulty with it after TEI that was discussed on the shift, I think, previous to the one I was on. And then we went back through and ran a complete EMS checkout and did a couple of bias checks on it, where we just let the accelerometer sit there and integrate and see how close it comes. All of these tests have worked out fine. We've also, by going back and talking with Frank, we've tentatively come to the conclusion that the initial difficulty that he had with it was probably that he moved some of the switches too fast as he goes through the test that he uses on it. He at that time also reported that it jumped some when he separated from the S4B. Now, we don't really have an explanation about why that happened. However, as best we can determine at this time, the EMS is functionally operable, and they will be able to use it as a monitoring technique during the entry. Now, I'd say one more thing. Generally, if you have a problem with this particular piece of gear, it's not a subtle, hard-to-detect difficulty. If it is not going to work, it will be very obvious, and then they would not trust it for any further information.
In addition to the planned television shows and the one practice show we saw today, have there been any other practice television shows?
I feel sure the answer to that question is no, and I think the spontaneity of our response when the rehearsal came up implies just that.
I think it was the first time we caught John McLeish during the flight.
Okay, right after this... right now, as a matter of fact, we'll ask Dick Underwood to come up, and for all of those that desire to look at a slide in which Dick can point out some of the features shown on the world, we'll be happy to oblige. Glenn? Yeah, why don't you fix him up? Hey, Glenn?
Well, this, of course, is a pretty large blow-up from the original, and was taken when they were about 97,000 nautical miles out at around 3 o'clock Houston time this afternoon. Working from the south up, the South Pole is... right down here on the edge, and we can see the west coast of South America over here and the east coast, South America in here. The terminator, of course, this time of the year is inclined about 22 degrees to the equator, so the North Pole then would be up about here in the darkness, so the Antarctica is lit up. If you remember, Captain Lovell mentioned the large storm in the South Pacific, which is right here. The Panama Canal area would be up in here, and the eastern point of South America over at this point. The flash you see in here is the subsolar point between the phase angle between the sun, the earth, and the spacecraft. Then we look on up into Central America, Yucatan Peninsula, and on up to the west coast of the United States. The Gulf of Mexico is around in here with Houston under the clouds. Right about in here. Florida coming on down this general vicinity and the island of Cuba, Hispaniola out through here. Then the front runs on up the east coast of the United States, and we're up around Nova Scotia in this area, and then northern Canada is in the darkness. The proposed splashdown area tomorrow morning is right out on the horizon, just about on the horizon out in this area, with the clouds of the intertropical convergence zone running across this way. I think that's a pretty quick summary of what we have in this photograph. Yeah. All right, if he can get the picture back on, we can give it a try here. These cloud formations are a little west of Florida, and Florida's coming on down in through here, pointing more or less this way. And we swing up the east coast toward Canada. The Texas area where we are right now is just about in here, because these clouds are out over the Gulf of Mexico, and then there's a small clear area, and then coastal area is cloudy, and the mouth of the Mississippi over and about here. And it swings on around and then on up. That about do it? Good enough.
Any further questions before we re-erect the lights?
Okay.